Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome back to New Books in Christian Studies, a channel on the New Books Network. I'm your host, Zach McCulley, and today I'm joined by Dr. Young Richard Kim, who is Associate Professor and Head of Classics and Mediterranean Studies, with an additional appointment in the Department of History at the University of Illinois Chicago. Young has edited a new volume with Cambridge University Press in the fantastic Cambridge Companion series. It's titled The Cambridge Companion to the Council of Nicaea, published in January of 2021. Young, congratulations on the book, and thank you for joining me today.
Thanks, Zach. It's a pleasure to be here.
Great. Well, it's great to have you here. And Young, I'm really looking forward to discussing this new book with you. Before we do that, though, can you share with our listeners a little more about your background and what you've worked on in the past?
Yeah. My editing this volume actually is a result of much of the work that I did in the earlier part of my career. So both as a graduate student and really for the first 10 years or so of my professional life, I wrote a lot and read a lot about Epiphanius of Cyprus, who was kind of the lead bishop of the island from 367 until his death in 403. And Epiphanius was famous for, first and foremost, for being a defender of what he understood to be orthodoxy or orthodox Christianity. And in this case, he was also staunchly pro-Nicene, and we can talk about what that means in a second. But he was also well known for being a kind of heresy hunter. So Epiphanius wrote a very large treatise called the Panarion, which describes the beliefs, practices, and refutations for 80 different heresies. And of course, included among those 80 heresies were the various offshoots of the thinking and the teaching of Arius, whom we'll talk about in a second. Because I had spent so much time thinking about this person and his ideas, the opportunity arose for me to kind of go back a little bit earlier. Epiphanius was certainly alive when the Council of Nicaea took place, but he would have been very young at the time. But it's really kind of the council and then the aftermath that overlaps exactly with the life of this figure that I studied. And so the chance to look at the Council of Nicaea, sort of looking backwards, but also looking forwards from the moment of the event itself, that was something really exciting for me, and that's how I ended up becoming the editor of this volume.
Very good.
Yeah.
Well, you know, this book, the Cambridge Companion to the Council of Nicaea, it's really well put together. You have a diverse set of contributors. Why don't we begin by just having you introduce us to the Council of Nicaea, where there've been generally two different perspectives on it that you mentioned in the introduction. It's been the subject of just a ton of literature over the years. Where does this book fit in?
Yeah, great question. So one of the fascinating things about the Council of Nicaea is that it's you know, arguably one of the most important moments in the history of Christianity. It's a, you know, what we call like a watershed moment or a turning point or, you know, whatever descriptor we want to use. But at the same time, it's also one that is really contested at every turn, you know, so the chronology is contested, the sources are few, but then they're also contested. The origins of the debate that led to the council, the different players involved in the lead up to and during and after the council, pretty much everything about the Council of Nicaea has a different sort of interpretive angle by scholars over, you know, really over the centuries. I'm really fascinated then by this moment that is, as I say in the introduction, you know, most Christians around the world, you know, at least know in part something about the Council of Nicaea, because most Christians around the world on Sunday recite what they understand to be the creed. You know, in the modern vocabulary of Christianity, the Council of Nicaea or the Nicene Creed is there. And yet it is this event that is really so debated. And I think in a lot of ways, that's what is also quite fascinating and really fun for those of us who kind of engage in this period, is that because we have this limited set of sources for this event, we can have these kind of radically different perspectives. Now, the point of view that I present in my introduction to the volume is the starting point actually is with this novel by Dan Brown. I'm sure many of our listeners will know The Da Vinci Code, and of course there was a Hollywood film that was made in adaptation of that novel, directed by Ron Howard. And so in that novel and in the movie, one of the characters, this kind of crotchety old man who knows all about history and conspiracies and this kinds of things, and I won't give away the plot if you don't know about it, but you know, he basically presents the Council of Nicaea as this conspiratorial moment where the Emperor Constantine, you know, the first Christian emperor, essentially made the decision or forced people to agree with his decision that Jesus Christ would now henceforth be understood and believed to be the Son of God, divine. As a result, then any points of view that go against him, go against the idea that Jesus is divine, would be considered heretical. And then any books or writings that would say anything other than Jesus is divine would be condemned, right? And so then this fits into the plot line of Brown's novel for a variety of reasons relating to the Holy Grail, but I won't get into that. But that's kind of one extreme polar end, you know, that this council decided Jesus was God. And then that was a kind of conspiracy or power play or however you want to present it. And then, of course, the other point of view is that, you know, this is a moment when something that's disputed as well. But this is a moment when the doctrine of the Trinity, you know, the belief that the divine Godhead or God, you know, exists, is one God, but exists in as three persons, that you know, people will say this, and this is probably something that I even learned, you know, when I was going to church growing up, is that, you know, the doctrine of the Trinity was defended here at the Council of Nicaea against heresy. So it's these kind of two extremes, conspiracy and defense of the faith, that lie at those two ends. And really, you know, the work of historians and scholars who study the Council of Nicaea, it's really the in-between spaces where a lot of our debates happen. And that's where it's kind of messy too, because there just are, you know, there's a limit of sources and a limit of what we can draw from them. And so hence we have these ongoing debates even to this day about the council.
Yeah, that's a great introduction and really, really helps frame the book for us. And, you know, this is a really comprehensive study that you've produced here. We've got essays on the council itself, what came of it, its reception, also the context, which are so important.
Yeah.
I'm wondering if you can share with us some of the social political context in the lead up to Nicaea. Maybe introduce us to some of the essays that sort of deal with that, with the complexity of, you know, these moving parts culturally, ideologically in those years, 312 to 324.
Yeah. Yeah. So what's really interesting too, is that one's academic discipline, you know, sort of the lenses by which we study the past or the sources that tell us about the past, in a lot of ways can and does inform how we understand the council's inception and causes, right? So, and what I mean by this is, you know, let's say if someone's a historian, then a historian necessarily wants to look at the political, the social, the cultural, perhaps economic, whatever sort of circumstances that lead to this event. Whereas someone who comes from a sort of theological angle, you know, really focuses in and hones in on the ideas. Right. And a philosopher might do that as well. Someone who's in coming to this from the perspective of religious studies, again, may look at questions of not only theology, but ritual and liturgy and perhaps even theoretical kind of explanations and causes for the council. So this is the kind of the nutshell, right? Because the Emperor Constantine is this figure that looms large in this volume, and it's something that I wanted to make sure came out. But what's actually really interesting, and this comes out in the essay by Raymond Van Dam, the first essay after the introduction, is that for most of the events leading up to 325, when the council happens, Constantine actually wasn't the emperor of that side or that half of the Roman Empire. It was Licinius. And so this local debate, a debate that erupts in Egypt, and Rebecca Lyman's essay really captures this well, that the reasons for why this debate, or why even Arius began to teach, you know, this idea of Jesus as a creature or a creation, this local debate slowly but surely spills out into the wider Eastern Mediterranean, right? And the dates for this are contested. Some scholars would say sort of in the 318 moving forward, others would say in the early 320s, but whatever the case may be, there is this local argument between Arius, this clergyman, and Alexander of Alexandria, who's the bishop of Alexandria, and basically the head of the church in Egypt. There's this theological debate then that leads to a letter writing campaign and mutual sort of condemnations, and ultimately the necessity for calling this council. But all the while, the Emperor Constantine, the guy who is so important to this conversation, is actually ruler of the western half of the empire. And so it's only in September of 324, when he finally defeats Licinius, that Constantine becomes the ruler of the entire empire. And in some ways, he inherits then this problem that has been sort of simmering, first in Egypt and then in the wider Eastern Mediterranean. He inherits this theological debate and argument. And that debate and argument has the potential to kind of rip the whatever unity or peace that Constantine has just achieved. It kind of has the chance to rip it apart. And so then that is one of the kind of main driving forces that leads to this event, the Council of Nicaea. So that kind of mix of political and theological and personal relationships and contests over power, these are all factors that we need to think about. And I haven't even really dived into the theology or the philosophical kind of atmosphere. And similarly with exegetical, you know, how people we're reading the scriptures and interpreting them, all of these factors, I don't think it's appropriate to single out any one of them as a way to understand why the Council of Nicaea happened, but really it's a sort of conglomeration of all of these. And that's one of the things that I wanted to do with this volume, was to get different kind of disciplinary perspectives to weigh in on the reasons that the council ultimately happens. So hopefully that gives you some sort of contextual background, but I'm happy to answer, you know, follow-up questions you might have.
Yeah, no, that's really helpful. And I think the context do come out really well there from the various authors there in that section. So that's really helpful. And if we now go to sort of zoom in on the event itself, maybe we could take David Gwynn's essay as a guide, perhaps. Can you walk us through who were the participants, the proceedings of the council, what all transpired at Nicaea?
Yeah, and this is where the debate continues, right? Because so one of the major challenges we face is that there are no surviving what we call acta, you know, of the council. So later councils, large councils like the Council of Ephesus and the Council of Chalcedon in 451, we have basically, I would call them the proceedings or the minutes, perhaps might be the way to describe them. But we have those documents that tell us about the sequence of events and discussion, or, you know, even the agenda. You can kind of reconstruct it. But for the Council of Nicaea, we don't have the acta. And so what we're left with then is we know some of the issues. We have some sources, particularly Eusebius of Caesarea is an important one, you know, who tell us about the actual event itself. But we have to kind of extrapolate and sort of reconstruct what happened, who was there, how many people were there. And these are all questions that David Gwynn explores in his essay that I think is really helpful, right? So so for one, you know, an important detail that I know, you know, people don't realize is that there was a kind of, there was a smaller council that actually happened before Nicaea. 324, late 324, perhaps early 325, we're not sure, but and even the very existence of this council is actually debated, but we have a Syriac letter that tells us about it. But there was a council held in Antioch, and at this council, which was presided by a bishop by the name of Osius or Hosius of Cordova, who was essentially Constantine's advisor with regard to Christianity. So Hosius hosted this council, and this council was very much in favor and support of Alexander of Alexandria, right? So Alexander was the one who had opposed Arius's ideas. And in the proceedings of this council, which also issued a kind of belief statement, there were three bishops, included among them Eusebius of Caesarea, who were provisionally condemned for basically holding erroneous beliefs. And so then when the actual Council of Nicaea itself, which originally was supposed to be held in a city called Ancyra, which is modern-day Ankara in Turkey, the Emperor Constantine actually decided to move the gathering from Ancyra instead to Nicaea. These are some details that come out in the essays by Ina Jacobs and by Harold Drake. But, you know, Constantine's decision to move the council, some of the reasons that he gave was the weather's better in Nicaea. Access for Western clergy to come to Nicaea was easier than to make their way to Ankara. Constantine's residence, the imperial residence, was in a nearby city, Nicomedia. And so for all of these reasons, the Council of Nicaea could have been the Council of Ancyra, but it wasn't. It was actually Nicaea. And so when Constantine called this council, he invited, you know, all of the bishops in theory to come on the imperial dime, you know, so they were actually given permission to use the imperial sort of network of travel. And, you know, they gathered in Nicaea. And again, this is an important question that Ina Jacobs explores in her essay. We're not exactly sure, like, what the space would have looked like, or if it could even accommodate how many, you know, people we think were there. And so the council, the traditional number for the participants is 318 bishops or signatories. But this is a later kind of tradition that actually has a basis, you know. So from Genesis 14:14, there's a description of Abraham's servants. And so that perfect number of 318 kind of was appropriated in later traditions about the Council of Nicaea. And different sources tell us different numbers, but we think between, let's say, you know, 200 to 300 you know, bishops would have participated in the proceedings. But on top of that, you know, every one of these bishops would have had an entourage, you know, of anywhere between 3 to 12 staff, clergy, support. And so the actual gathering at Nicaea, and this is something David Gwynn explores too, is we could have had probably somewhere in the range of 2,000 people, you know, all milling about at this event. And what was so just monumental, and I think if I was there, if I put myself in my in my bishop's shoes there, terrifying about this gathering is that the emperor of the Roman world, he was there, and David does a great job of helping us set this scene that Eusebius describes of Constantine coming into the gathering, you know, and Eusebius describes him almost like an angelic being coming in, and Constantine sort of keeps his head and his eyes down as a way to demonstrate his humility. But the fact that the emperor opened the council, you know, he's sort of the master of ceremonies who got it started. Although Eusebius is pretty emphatic that once the proceedings began, he just sort of took a back seat to what unfolded. But the fact that the emperor was there is such an important detail that is, I think, in many ways underappreciated. And one of the reasons why is not a decade earlier, you know, a little over a decade before this, you know, Christians in particularly the eastern half of the empire, they were actually still experiencing, you know, active persecution. So people who were at the council lived through the persecutions of the early fourth century. And of course, the perpetrator, if we can say that, of the persecutions was the imperial state. And so here now, the head of that state, the emperor, is at the council. And so his opening of this, I think, really marks a profoundly important moment. And I would say, like, deeply terrifying. Now, Eusebius again emphasizes that Constantine's, apparently his bodyguard wasn't in the hall where they met, and so maybe that was a little less frightening, but nevertheless, I think that's an important detail. And so from that point, the beginning of the council, the dates are again argued, May or June of 325, but then we have this kind of series of debates that we have like glimpses of, right? And of course, the one of the first issues that had to be resolved was whether or not to seat those three bishops who had been provisionally deposed or condemned at the Council of Antioch. And once that's resolved, then they kind of get into the heart of the issue. And again, it's not exactly clear, but one of the key players here that needs to also be allowed to participate fully is Eusebius of Nicomedia, right? So there are two Eusebiuses that are really important players in this, in the council. Eusebius of Caesarea, who's a sort of bishop and a historian, and he writes a biography of Constantine. And then Eusebius of Nicomedia, who's actually a really powerful and influential bishop. And he is a supporter of and a partisan on behalf of Arius. And others who support Arius. And so Eusebius's presence here is then contrasted with the presence of Alexander of Alexandria, and most likely Alexander's younger support staff member, Athanasius, who will, of course, later succeed him. And so, you know, the traditional perspective then is that you have these two sort of camps, you know, one side pro Arius, the other side pro Alexander. And then they have this kind of debate and argument over theology. But I think the essays in the volume two, and David's point as well, David Gwynn, is that actually the two camps idea is a way oversimplification, because there was a lot of fluidity and a lot of kind of uncertainty, and different theologians were along the kind of two polar ends and in the in-between spaces. And so really, this debate is not necessarily just between two sides, but a really kind of a bunch of different perspectives, perhaps even some bishops who weren't persuaded one way or the other, maybe even some who came with an open mind and were really intently listening in on the arguments that were presented. But whatever the case may be, the proceedings are obviously contentious, but they're eventually resolved by the promulgation of a creed, which we can talk about, some anathemas or condemnations that accompany that creed. And then there's some depositions, including Arius. Arius is deposed and sent into exile. And so there's this month-long council debate. And there are other issues, too, that come up. The date of Easter and how to calculate it. There are canons. So these sort of proclamations by the council for various issues relating to the church. And so, you know, among these, there were some other issues, including a schism in Egypt. But all this to say, we have to kind of reconstruct as best we can what we know of the proceedings. But I can tell you that they were messy. And maybe that's the last thing I will leave you with.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccoli, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Well, Young, you mentioned the creed, and I want to get to the outcomes of the Council of Nicaea. Yeah. What we think of immediately, a lot of readers do, is the Nicene Creed. How did the production of this one compare to the production of other creeds?
Yeah.
And can you speak to how it was received right there off the bat? What was its immediate reception?
Yeah, this is a great question. So, I mean, we know, of course, that churches before the Council of Nicaea had creeds, or what we might perhaps say in a less formal way, professions or statements of faith. And in particular, you know, we know that churches in various cities in the empire had these statements that would be recited at the time an individual was baptized into the church, right? So baptismal creeds or baptismal statements or, statements like this used in a liturgical function setting, we know those were around. And then, you know, there had been up to this point a growing tradition among, you know, some of the important sort of Christian writers of the early church, who in their own respective works were putting together what roughly might be described as creeds or statements that articulate some theological perspective. So someone like Irenaeus of Lyon, for example, you know, in his writings, you know, he speaks of a rule of faith, a canon of faith, or, and this might be more of a principle, but nevertheless, even in his writings, he offers some statements that profess what Christians, Orthodox or correct, you know, correctly believing Christians might believe. And some scholars even think that even in the New Testament, that we might see some kind of, you know, creedal statements. So the famous sort of kenosis statement of Philippians 2, for example, would be one example of that. So creeds aren't unfamiliar to people, but at the Council of Nicaea, what's really quite interesting is that Eusebius of Caesarea tells us that in order for him to be seated, because he had been provisionally condemned, he produced the baptismal creed of his city, of Caesarea, which upon analysis, at least according to his point of view, was deemed to be acceptable. And in fact, Eusebius seems to insinuate that the creed of Caesarea was kind of the basis for what would become the Nicene Creed. Although Mark Edwards in his essay, I think, complicates that and challenges that. And so what seems to have happened is there seems to have been a kind of committee or a commission that sat down and composed, put together the creed. And one of the most important and ultimately contentious points of this creed was the insertion of this word homoousios. Okay? And I know some of our listeners will know this word, because, you know, if anyone who's taken a church history course knows, homoousios is this word that we translate into English as roughly something like consubstantial or the same substance. And so there are sort of endless debates about who introduced this word, homoousios. Eusebius even says that Constantine suggested this. Other scholars have sort of looked at Hosius of Cordova or Alexander of Alexandria. But what's interesting is that this term that was used to describe the relationship between the Father and the Son as being of the same substance, the term itself was actually condemned or at least rejected in the previous century over a different theological debate. But whatever the case may be, this committee or this small group of theologians at the Council of Nicaea decided that homoousios would be this word that helps to resolve this debate, right? And the debate is, what is the relationship between the Father and the Son? And ultimately, for Arius, it seems that, again, Arius isn't saying that Jesus doesn't have this, you know, divineness about him, but that nevertheless, that the Arius seems to have argued that Jesus came to be. He was created. And in that way, then he has a beginning point, right? Whereas if the, on the other side of this debate, or, to use that kind of binary, which I earlier said we shouldn't, but nevertheless, you know, this the other side of the perspective would say, if we acknowledge that Jesus is of the same substance of God, and God is eternal, unchanging, then the implication is the same for the Son, right? So then you would affirm the eternal eternality of the Son, that he's not a created being, right? And begottenness will become this descriptor to help explain that, or if we're more specific, an eternal begottenness. But that's a debate for a later time. But all this to say, you know, homoousios was presented as this word that would then resolve this debate, and Constantine seems to have been happy about this. Now, one of the problems with homoousios, when you say substance, right? Even in English, the word in Greek is ousia, but in English, the word substance implies like stuff that you can touch, right? Something material. So I don't know, think of like silly putty, you know, that's a substance that I can kind of mold and shape in a way that I want. And so if you introduce the language of substance when you talk about God, for some theologians, that was a real problem, because it seemed to suggest that God is material, right? And if God is material, then the question is, well, who made that material? Where did that material come from? And that's obviously something you can't say about God, you know, in this case, we'll say God the Father, you know, whereas you might be able to say that about the Son. But nevertheless, homoousios becomes this really contested terminology. Almost everyone signs on to the creed, even Eusebius of Caesarea. But what's really interesting is that Eusebius, sort of immediately afterward, you know, writes a letter that we have that he wrote back to his home congregation, in which he explains his particular understanding of homoousios, right? And in a way that still affirms the sort of theology that he espoused and didn't fully agree with, let's say, the perspective presented by Alexander of Alexandria. So all this to say, then, the Nicene Creed, which, you know, we recite, you know, Christians recite a form of it in their churches today. It's actually an adaptation of this of the Nicene Creed. But homoousios, this idea of consubstantial, for, you know, this earlier I talked about that kind of one polar end of the perspective that this was a defense of the faith. Christians now, you know, would say homoousios, you know, clearly affirmed the divinity, the correlative divinity of Jesus the Son relative to the Father, in relation to the Father. And whereas in actuality, and this is the follow-up to the second half of your question, is that essentially once the council was over, the Council of Nicaea itself, as well as the creed, they were almost immediately kind of set aside, and in some ways ignored. And really what the Council of Nicaea did, and its creed, rather than firmly establishing and articulating and clearly stating, you know, what was to be the Orthodox belief about the relationship between the Father and the Son, actually catalyzed decades of debate. and what actually unfolds, and you know, people can read this by these events in the works of other scholars, you know, Richard Hansen, Lewis Ayres, John Baer, et cetera. Essentially, the debate just rages. And so the Council of Nicaea and its creed were, in fact, kind of the sparks that lit this flame that led to dozens of councils. It seems like, you know, the mid-300s, the mid-4th century, was the era of sort of nonstop councils. And many of these councils were also issuing new creeds, right? So there are a bunch of creeds that come out of this time as well. And each council, depending on who was hosting it and who dominated the proceedings, each of those creeds then reflected the particular theological view of the participants. So really, the aftermath, if the proceedings were messy, Zach, then the aftermath was even messier. that's what's so fascinating about this, is that this watershed moment, this moment that for a lot of Christians was the defining moment that Jesus was affirmed as divine, was in fact the opposite. It became just the spark that initiated this huge conflagration of debate for the next several decades.
Yeah, that's really good, and I want to follow up on reception in the aftermath, because part four of the book it deals with the aftermath up until that fourth century, or to the end of the fourth century rather, and you see figures come up in some of those essays: Athanasius, the Cappadocian Fathers, Hilary, Augustine. Mm. Can you talk to us about how some of these figures, how they were able to appropriate the Trinitarian ideas that came up in Nicaea into their various theological strands?
Yeah, that's a great question. And the essays in this section, I think, are really interesting, too, because it shows the extent to which this conflagration that I mentioned was raging on. But at the same time, there is a slow and steady move toward what we might call a consensus, you know, and this is Mark Del Colliano's essay is really helpful, because he demonstrates how the role of the Cappadocian fathers, in particular Basil of Caesarea and Gregory of Nazianzus, but of course Gregory of Nyssa too, but how the work of these theologians was a series of moments where they're kind of refining and honing and carefully articulating different points of debate to come to a consensus understanding of not only the relationship between the Father and the Son, but, and this is something I haven't mentioned at all, and again, might be a surprise to some of our listeners, but the Holy Spirit hasn't even really been a part of this conversation up to this point, you know? And so even though we often say that the Council of Nicaea and the Nicene Creed affirms the doctrine of the Trinity, in fact, what it did was actually open the debate about the binity, right? The relationship between the Father and the Son. And it's only a little bit later, and in particular, Athanasius of Alexandria picks up this conversation and debate about the Holy Spirit, where the Spirit's place in this divine Godhead becomes part of the larger conversation, 350s moving forward. The Cappadocian Fathers are helpful in building a consensus. And in particular, and again, this is some of the technical kind of nitty-gritty of this, but one of the issues that was constantly debated was the difference between two theological terminologies. One is the word ousia, which I mentioned earlier, the word that we translate as substance. And then the other word that was part of this that became sort of debated was hypostasis, right? And hypostasis is, a complicated legacy term, but it can be an existence, a being, or a person. And so prior to the Council of Nicaea, and then even in the aftermath, many theologians actually use those terms interchangeably. One hypostasis, one ousia, in fact, became a kind of theological point. And so one of the things that the Cappadocians did that was important was, and there were other theologians who were doing this as well, but they made a clear distinction between the word substance and then the word person. So there were some theologians who argued that God is one hypostasis, right? Only. And they use that interchangeably then with the word one substance, one ousia. But by making this subtle but important distinction between ousia and hypostasis, then ultimately what happened was the Cappadocian fathers, and with Athanasius contributing to this as well, is that they could articulate the Godhead as one ousia, one substance, kind of affirming the divinity of all of the Godhead, but identifying three distinct hypostases, right? Three persons. And so by making this distinction then, and Trinitarian theology is you know, complicated and can make your head spin, but by making this careful distinction, what was part of this consensus building movement is that then you could have this doctrine or this belief that affirms on the one hand the singular unity and divinity of God, but on the other hand it could also affirm the distinct persons in this Godhead that share this one ousia. And so that was kind of one of the major points that lead us to, you know, the next ecumenical council, so to speak, the Council of Constantinople in 381. But this is a debate that rages for decades, right? And there are different ideas and different perspectives offered all along the way. You know, and some of your listeners might, for example, be familiar with the term homoi ousios, with that yoda in there, right? And homoi ousios is a term that means, you know, something like a similar substance. So not the same substance, homo ousios, but similar, homoi ousios. And in fact, Athanasius seems to have thought that there's a way to actually accommodate homoi ousios, and he tried with a faction of theologians who supported this idea. He tried to build a kind of alliance with them that ultimately didn't work out. But, you know, these are fine points of difference that different theologians were arguing. And of course, some of the more extreme ones, one perspective said, let's get rid of ousia language altogether. Let's ignore it completely because it doesn't appear in scripture in reference to God. So one perspective said, let's not have ousia at all. Let's just stop talking about that. And then another point of view said, another one said, in fact, the Father and the Son are different substances, right? As a way to really demonstrate a separation between the two. So all this to say that in the aftermath, these various theologians who are arguing about these perspectives, you know, there are these constant shifts and innovations and refinements. And you know, I'm not even really mentioning sort of the political dimension of this, but so much of this also had to do with relationships, right? And networks, and ultimately power too. Like people who were in positions of power had the voice that was heard and louder. And, you know, one could argue that someone like Athanasius, even though he himself was exiled, you know, five different times, you know, he's one of these very, very powerful voices because he was the archbishop or the bishop of Alexandria. So I hope that, again, shows just how messy things are. But amid the messiness, there is a move toward what we might call consensus.
Yeah, that's really helpful. Well, Young, if we move then to look at the long reception,
yeah,
because there's been a number of years that have gone by, even from those sections we were just talking about at the end of the fourth century. And this final section of the book, it deals with the long reception, looking at these two distinct traditions. Those are the Eastern churches and then the West as well. There's essays that cover just a lot of material and kind of show Nicaea, as you've said earlier on, as kind of a reference point for later councils and issues. Mm. But I want to ask specifically about Jeffrey Dunn's essay, where he talks about modern receptions, or a modern Catholic reception of Nicaea. Can you share with us just briefly, as we're wrapping up here, what Dunn contributes?
Yeah, I'll say that long reception section is again a really interesting one. And you know, full disclosure, I had originally commissioned an essay to also talk about Protestant receptions of Nicaea. But unfortunately, you know, that essay fell through. And so what we're left with are two very fine essays about the Orthodox and then the Catholic reception. And so Jeffrey Dunn's essay, he talks about the Catholic reception. And I think what really comes out from his essay, you know, by the time we reach even the 5th century, the 5th century, where a new debate is kind of raging, and that's the sort of, you know, it's a stereotype to say so, but the 5th century is the debate about Christology, right? The incarnation of Christ. But, and by the way, Mark Smith has a great book on the function of the use of the Council of Nicaea in the 5th century councils. You know, so by the 5th century, the Council of Nicaea is almost a like a sine qua non. Like basically, it's a foundation point of theology, right? By this point, partly because of imperial intervention, you know, theologians across the empire accept and acknowledge the Council of Nicaea and its creed as orthodoxy. It's a given, right? And if you deny that, then you're not a Christian. And so, and then, you know, this is also sort of when we introduce this concept of a ecumenical council, right? That all of the universal church acknowledges the Council of Nicaea as the first ecumenical council. And so in the Catholic tradition, you know, Jeff shows that, you know, Nicaea is kind of a signpost, a mile marker, a point of the history of the church that is kind of like what I alluded to earlier. This point that is a watershed moment, a no compromise. You know, once the doctrine of the Trinity, so to speak, is affirmed according to tradition by the Council of Nicaea, then moving forward, the Council of Nicaea is kind of the foundational point for all other conciliar gatherings, right? And so what's interesting then is that, and this is tied to a lot of historical developments, but as the East and the West, their destinies are moving in different directions, you know, the Orthodox Church acknowledges the sort of first 7 councils as ecumenical councils shared by the churches. And then as each side has their own particular trajectories, the Western Church and what eventually we might call the Roman Catholic Church, they have many other councils that that the church acknowledges and recognizes as, you know, authoritative or what we might call ecumenical. And so, you know, the East and West have these kind of diverging trajectories. Sure, it has to do with theology and liturgy and ecclesiology, but it also has to do with, you know, empires and politics and power and this kind of thing. But we're moving in different directions. What I think is really helpful in again, Jeffrey's essay is he also shows the extent to which the canons of Nicaea, and I know we didn't have time to talk about these very much, but the canons also become very, very important signal posts, markers of proper practice. And so even as the Catholic Church has this really rich and sophisticated development of canon law, and this is something that does come out in Andreas Weckfert's essay about the canons, but, you know, canon law and you know, sort of the rules that govern the church and its life and the life of its members, the Council of Nicaea and its canons, the echoes and the traces of the council last, you know, until this very day. You know, and in that way, I think Jeffrey really shows how, you know, the legacy of this historical event is has lasting implications. And you know, maybe this is the best way to close this conversation, is that, as I mentioned, you know, as Christians around the world recite this creed every Sunday, you know, that shows this incredibly long-lasting legacy of this event, even if the memory of it is fuzzy for a lot of people. And then, of course, the actual events themselves are deeply contested. But nevertheless, I don't think there's any denying that the Council of Nicaea and its creed have this lasting impact to our very day.
That's really well said there. Appreciate that. Yeah. And Young, you've been really gracious with your time. We want to let you go, but real quick before we do that, can you share with our listeners what you plan to work on next?
Yeah. So as I mentioned, I spent a lot of my career working on this Bishop Epiphanios of Cyprus, Epiphanius. Right. And in some ways, I feel like my relationship with him has gone on long enough. And so I'm trying to move on to other projects. And so, you know, I'm actually working, I'm actually trained as an ancient historian. So my expertise is really is in late antique history. And so I'm writing a book now on the island of Cyprus. So there's still a connection because Epiphanius was the lead bishop of Cyprus. But I'm really interested in the history of this island. I think particularly from the 4th through the 7th centuries. And of course, the history of Christianity and in particular hagiography is very much a part of understanding Cyprus in this period, but that's my current project. So very different than Epiphanios, and certainly different from the Council of Nicaea. But you know, there are obviously going to be points of intersection as well.
Well, we'll be sure to look out for future work from you. It'd be great to have you back on the show. But for now, thanks for editing this volume. Yep. with Cambridge. It's called the Cambridge Companion to the Council of Nicaea. It was published January 2021. Young, thank you so much for joining me.
Zach, it was a pleasure, and I thank you for your really poignant and thoughtful questions.
Great. And thank you all for listening. We'll see you next time on New Books in Christian Studies, a channel on the New Books Network.